It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
This morning about canceling the contract for the new Air Force One. Is that something you're serious about trying to do?
Well, the plane is totally out of control. It's going to be over $4 billion. It's for Air Force One program. And I think it's ridiculous. I think Boeing is doing a little bit of a number. We want Boeing to make a lot of money, but not that much money. Okay, thank you.
That was not a new clip this morning, but we didn't get to play it this weekend. I loved it. So I wanted you to hear it. Boeing is in the process, of course, of developing new Air Force One planes, and they cost tons and tons of money, huge amounts, as someone would say. And that was the president-elect's response to that. I just found it refreshing. And by the way, you surely know by now that Michigan has halted its recount. The same federal judge that authorized it in the wee hours of the morning last weekend has now stopped it. And the whole point is that Jill Stein is not an aggrieved candidate. She did not come close enough to winning that election to lay claim to a total recount of Michigan. They'd already started it, but now they have stopped it. So Donald Trump will remain the winner in Michigan, winning all of their electoral votes. And we'll find out, you know, what's going to happen in Wisconsin. But that's what's happened with that. I think Donald Trump's going to be the president. I know that's a shock, but I actually think that's going to happen. And, of course, this week has been filled with nominations. We already had Michael Flynn, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, controversial to the left because of his hard stand on radical Islam, because of his lack of obeisance to the Obama administration. And so we have a lot of things that have been happening. And let's just kind of recap some of the things that happened this week. Here's Garrett Tenney on Fox.
This latest pick makes it three generals now that President-elect Trump has selected to serve in his cabinet. Retired Marine General John Kelly confirms to Fox News he has been asked to head the Department of Homeland Security. An official announcement is expected in the next couple of days, but the selection of Kelly is certainly another sign that Mr. Trump is serious about securing the country's southern border. For the last 3 years, Kelly has served as the head of the U.S. military's Southern Command, which includes the southern border, and regularly involved immigration enforcement. Senior transition officials also confirm Mr. Trump has now settled on his choice to head the EPA. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, who may prove to be among the more controversial of the president-elect's picks. Pruitt, after all, has been an outspoken critic of the agency he's now been asked to head and has repeatedly sued the EPA to roll back environmental regulations. Now, despite the outcry from liberal and activist groups, Mr. Trump's team says they are not worried about his confirmation.
We're very accustomed to the naysayers and the critics, so and we know some people are still running a permanent campaign, but Attorney General Pruitt has great qualifications and a good record as the AG of Oklahoma, and there were a number of qualified candidates for that particular position that the president-elect interviewed, and he settled on Attorney General Pruitt, and we'll look forward to the confirmation hearings.
One more cabinet selection we now know of as well is former wrestling executive Linda McMahon, who has been nominated to head the Small Business Administration. Here's a look at the remaining cabinet seats Mr. Trump has to fill, which includes, of course, the turbulent selection of the next Secretary of State, as well as the Secretaries of Agriculture, Energy, Interior, Labor, and Veterans Affairs.
All right, so that's Garrett Tenney of Fox, and that's kind of where we are. It's been a wild ride, and I have to say, I am excited. I'm thrilled. I am so excited that these men who have shown themselves to be courageous in their various venues are now going to be tasked to sort out the mess that has become this country. People who actually seem to care about the country and the best interests of its people being put in place to actually do something about it. It's going to be a slog. I would be lying if I said anything else. You have to know that It's not just the heads of the agencies. It's the thousands upon thousands of federal workers and appointees who have entrenched themselves in the system in Washington, D.C. and around the country, who will have to be somehow dealt with, managed, moved on. You know, it's very hard to fire a federal worker. And so it's not going to be like suddenly Donald Trump will be president and this cabinet in its various configuration and all these appointments will take their places. Then they have to deal with an agency, each of them, that will have thousands of people that will be opposed to them. And, you know, it's one thing for the head of the agency to decide to do something. It's quite another thing for the rank and file to actually carry it out. They have their ways of stopping it. And so this is going to be the battle that's going to lie ahead. I want to go back to something I talked about quite a bit this week because it's an update on it. I've been warning you about this whole notion of, well, first of all, we talked about the alt-right, that made-up term. The left loves to make up terms, and then the right loves to repeat them and start using them. There is no such thing, as far as I could tell, of the alt-right. This is a term that's used to broad sweep any conservative organization that doesn't agree with the radical left agenda that's expressed through most of the mainstream media. So most of us are what they call the alt-right. I'm not using that. We are America. We actually are the Americans who love this country and care about its nature and its borders, its healthcare, care about the way we do war and send our soldiers into battle. We are the mainstream America, and they are the alt-left, and they are represented by the main media. But now they've coined this new phrase, and you're hearing it, but I want to go back to it because I spent a lot of time on it a couple of days ago. If you did not hear that show, I hope that you'll go back and look at it and listen to it because it's really important because now they're using the term fake news. Fake news, you see, fake news. Anything that they don't report is fake news. And it kind of started, this is not the total start, but it sort of, you can trace it to November 24th. The Washington Post published a story on the work of four sets of researchers who have examined what they say are Russian propaganda efforts to undermine American democracy and interests. Now, one of those was a website called Prop or Not, a group that insists on public anonymity, which issued a report identifying more than 200 websites that, in its view, wittingly or unwittingly published or echoed Russian propaganda. So you get this. The Washington Post is citing a group called Prop or Not. They're supposed to be the experts on deciding what is fake news and what is Russian propaganda efforts. Now, they won't tell us who these people are in Prop or Not. They won't divulge their methodology, but they just cite them. They know. They are in the know. And whatever they say must be true. They have published all these 200 websites that they claim are fake news. Well, I told you a couple of days ago that one of those, which was Naked Capitalism, is threatening to sue them for defamation, because they're damaging false accusations, and they are demanding that the Washington Post debunk the list of fake news sites that they published earlier on November the 24th. Now, here's another follow-up on this. Zero Hedge has a great article on this morning. We'll put this on our Facebook page. Washington Post appends Russian propaganda fake news story, admits it may be fake. In the latest example, why the mainstream media is facing a historic crisis of confidence among its readership, facing unprecedented blowback following Craig Denberg's November 24th Washington Post story, Russian propaganda effort helped spread fake news during election. On Wednesday, a lengthy editor's note, meaning an editor of the Washington Post, appeared on top of the original article, in which the editor not only distances the Washington Post from the quote-unquote experts quoted in the article, whose work, quote-unquote, served as the basis for the entire article, and which has become the most read Washington Post story the day it was published. But it also admits the Post could not, quote, vouch for the validity of Prop or Not's, that's the name, Prop or Not, finding regarding any individual media outlet, and in effect admitting that the entire story may have been, a drumroll, fake news. All right, so these fake news sites, they're not fake news sites. I shouldn't repeat that name. Those fake news sites published by the Washington Post by the fake group Prop or Not is now in deep trouble because some of these sites are threatening to sue them, and they should. They should. This should be stopped. And I want to read, this is an article from the Daily Caller that came out about this. We'll put this on our Facebook page, too, because it's so good. It's called Journalists Struggle to Define Fake News Even as They Declare War on It. So the Daily Caller says, liberal journalists have launched an all-out assault on fake news, which some have blamed for the disconnect between political journalists and everyday Americans. But many of those same journalists seem unable to agree on a consistent definition of what, quote, fake news, end quote, is, oftentimes pushing leading conservative and alternative media organizations that provide ideological balance in the public forum under the same fake news umbrella, alongside websites whose entire purpose is generating viral hoaxes. So, in other words, like BuzzFeed, which is an outlet of Newsweek, their coverage of fake news, which has been the subject of accusations of misleading the public, has focused on hoax websites run by teenagers. So they then will put places like the one I just quoted. Naked Capitalist is one of them. Zero Hedge is another one of them. There's a long list. Put them in the same category as these honestly silly website started by teenagers who are pushing silly things on the internet. We all know about silly things on the internet. So they're trying to combine those two. Let me go ahead with this Daily Caller. A list of fake news sites compiled by a liberal college professor, a list that was uncritically accepted and distributed by some liberal journalists, included top right-of-center sites like Independent Journal, The Blaze. Left-leaning media organizations like the Los Angeles Times and the New York Magazine distributed this list to their readers. One website that the Washington Post labeled fake news without providing a single piece of evidence is threatening to sue the Post, and we've talked about that. That's Naked Capitalism. And here is from some liberal journalists are lumping in legitimate news organizations alongside objectively false sites while at the same time calling for censorship of fake news has led to concerns that the crackdown on fake news sites, the actual influence of which remains unknown, will be used by liberals to censor their conservative competitors. Forbes contributor Frank Miniter argued that some liberals are using the fake news controversy to invite government control over First Amendment-protected speech or by asking Facebook and Twitter to become even bigger censors of certain views. There's a lot more to that article, but of course that goes to what I had expanded on with you earlier in the week. And again, I recommend the show we did on that. Adam, maybe you could remind me which day it was because I can't remember. But we know that an international body has, a commission out of the European Union has gotten Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Microsoft to agree to start controlling what news they allow on their sites. In fact, Facebook has gone so far as to decide they're going to sort of create and establish which news outlets they're going to use. They will be then in every single person's Facebook feed. You'll get the news they want you to know. And then you run in danger, of course, of not hearing the things that are actually true from the sites that you trust. In fact, just to give you a case in point, Conservative HQ wrote an article this week on the boycott against Kellogg's by Breitbart because Kellogg's is removing advertising from Breitbart, accusing them of being, you know, an alt-right group and not a, you know, it's got, what, 45 million monthly viewers. And so Kellogg's and other companies have decided to remove their advertising. So now I'm boycotting Kellogg's. I could tell you that right now. But Conservative HQ wanted to report about this, and Facebook censored their article. So that's how ridiculous this is getting. So we need to be prepared to fight back. We'll talk more about what that might mean. But coming up next, Stan Kurtz, one of my favorites, is going to talk about another nomination that was kind of lost in the week, but it is a very big deal. Dr. Ben Carson, he's nominated to be the head of Housing and Urban Development. It is an incredibly important to all of us. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Merry Christmas from American Family Radio and Sandy Rios in the morning.
President-elect reaching out to a former rival, picking Dr. Ben Carson as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
We're excited to have Dr. Carson as our intended nominee for Housing and Urban Development. We're looking forward to another very productive week in the transition that's setting a historic pace.
Carson, a neurosurgeon, lacked significant experience in housing and urban development. During the primary, he criticized housing regulations to address segregation in public housing.
This is what you see in communist countries, where they have so many regulations encircling every aspect of your life that if you don't agree with them, all they have to do is pull the noose. And this is what we've got now.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. No wonder they don't want Dr. Ben Carson to be the head of housing and urban development. You know, this is an issue that I don't think, I know, hardly anyone understands. The Housing and Urban Development Agency was sort of formulated, as I recall, in the 60s, and we associate it with things like good times. Remember Florida and her family, JJ, living in the housing, you know, public housing in New York. And then I remember growing up in Chicago, Cabrini Green and all the public housing. It was a way to provide affordable housing for poor people, right? That's what HUD, I think, initially was intended to be, but it has grown into something very different. And I don't think there's anyone in the country who understands this and has written about it more thoroughly than our next guest. Stan Kurtz is a graduate of Harvard. He has done a lot of work in India. He's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a former adjunct professor with the Hudson Institute. I met Stan. He was formerly at the University of Chicago. And since I'm from Chicago, that's when I first met him. He has done some great work through the years. I have to say, he's one of the finest researchers. And I always find, I'll just say this, Stan, that Stan's work is always so absolutely trustworthy and measured. And so that's why it's always a privilege to talk to him. And I knew that he would have an opinion on the selection of Dr. Ben Carson for the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Stan, thank you for joining me this morning.
Well, Sandy, thanks so much for having me.
Now, it is interesting because Dr. Ben Carson, you know, neurosurgeon, now is going to be heading up public, you know, I'm reducing this to public housing. I know there's a great deal more, but what do you think just in general of that notion that someone with his qualifications could do this job?
Well, fundamentally, I like the idea of the appointment, but there are going to be challenges because of Dr. Carson's lack of specific experience in the housing area. I very much like the fact that during the campaign, Dr. Carson went at this terribly ill-considered and overreaching new regulation of President Obama's affirmatively furthering fair housing. Very few people mentioned it during the campaign. Ben Carson went at it. He criticized it for exactly the right reasons. And in general, I think Ben Carson has an understanding of conservative principles, which he brought to bear on housing issues in that case, and which I think he could do successfully in others. So I think his instincts are all the right instincts. It's a question of whether he gets advice from enough knowledgeable people about the specifics of bureaucratic infighting and of housing issues in particular to overcome the immense bureaucratic inertia that will be placed against him. And during confirmation, I think people are going to hit him hard, both on his lack of bureaucratic experience, which some of his close friends have actually given some material to feed the critics on the other side by saying, well, he doesn't have that much experience. And so they'll point to that again and again. And they'll point to his absolutely justified attacks on the Obama administration's overreaching housing policy. And they'll claim that he's against civil rights. But it's really not like that at all.
You know, it is interesting to me that he even accepted this post. You know, of all the things, you know, he would be a ringer for Surgeon General. He would be a ringer for other things. But this obviously, Stan, one thing in his column, from my perspective, is that he must want to do this. And he certainly grew up in public housing, and he understands the problems of it probably experientially better than any of us. So in that regard, maybe the passion that he has will help him to hire the right staff and do what he needs to do. I'm just curious, just to put this in context. You know, I started by the silly illustration, you know, of Good Times, that sitcom in the 60s with the black family living in housing in New York, which was a great, it was fun. And but I always think of HUD as starting during that time. I don't know if that was the origin of HUD. Was it?
HUD, the basic idea of HUD goes back to the Fair Housing Act passed under President Johnson during the period of the Great Society. And actually, it was George Romney, Mitt Romney's father, who was the first secretary of HUD during this period. And HUD has been an important cabinet post since then. And the interesting thing is that during the 60s, after the urban riots that tore across the nation in the late 60s, housing was an absolutely top-line national issue, and you read about it everywhere all the time. There was major reporting on it. And what we're seeing now is that President Obama has put in these immensely ambitious and, I think, terribly ill-considered new housing regulations that could truly transform the country, and yet no one discusses it, no one reports on it. Housing has gone from being a major public issue to one that's barely discussed, and each party, I think, has its own reasons for refusing to talk about the issue, but it's no less important than it used to be.
And, of course, this is not the first time you and I have discussed this, and you've been on the show before talking about it, but because it is so complex, and because no one ever talks about it, as we said, go back and revisit. There was a new policy that you wrote about that we're going to talk about secondly, will be TOD, Transit-Oriented Development, and we'll get to that in a second, but let's revisit this affirmatively furthering fair housing.
Part of the trick is that nobody can even say the name of this regulation.
Yeah, really.
That's a good way to keep it from being discussed.
Was this done by legislation, or was it an executive order, or combination?
This was an executive order of President Obama's affirmatively furthering fair housing, and the regulation claims to simply be putting down into detail certain obligations that have always existed since the passage of the Fair Housing Act in, I believe it was 1968. But the truth is that President Obama, using the cover of a few loose words in the Fair Housing Act, has in fact laid down a regulation that is equivalent to new law. This is a great example of the way in which President Obama has been making new law, circumventing the Congress, doing things that were nowhere contemplated by Congress through his regulations, and yet claiming that all he's really doing is just carrying out and enforcing the law. That's really not true at all.
Stan, let me read a paragraph from your own piece. You write often for National Review. This is in the one you wrote in July of 2015, Massive Government Overreach, Obama's AFFH Rule is Out. Okay, here's the paragraph. AFFA is easily one of President Obama's most radical initiatives, on a par with Obamacare and its transformative potential. In effect, AFFH gives the federal government a lever to re-engineer nearly every American neighborhood, imposing a preferred racial and ethnic composition, densifying housing, transportation, and business development in suburb and city alike, and weakening or casting aside the authority of local governments over core responsibilities from zoning to transportation to education. I just think that makes it clear, Stan, except not the details. Like what we have mentioned Westchester County in New York, which is where Mrs. Clinton is from. That was kind of one of the first neighborhoods that they tried to implement this idea. And what did they do?
Well, Sandy, Westchester County, like so many neighborhoods, really the majority of local governments around the country, usually at the county level, sometimes the city level, receive grant money from the Department of Housing and Urban Development called Community Development Block Grants. This really amounts to millions and millions of dollars that come into local communities across the entire country. And whenever you get that money, you have to sign a little form that says, we promise to fulfill the goals of the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And so what the Obama administration regulation is doing is basically over-interpreting what that little promise means and saying, well, according to this promise, even if there's no record of discrimination in Westchester County or any of the jurisdictions that accept this federal grant money, that's not good enough. You're going to have to give us a detailed accounting of who lives where in your jurisdiction by race, by ethnicity, and by income. And if we don't like it, if we, the federal government, think it's out of balance, then we're going to take your federal grant money away unless, say, you build high-density, low-income housing in, let's say, a well-to-do, upper-middle-class, predominantly white suburb of your area. So basically, the federal government is saying, we're going to take away the millions of dollars that you get in your federal grants unless you start changing the ethnic and racial and income composition of your district, and unless you change your zoning laws to, let's say that you're zoned, as most suburbs are, for single family housing. That housing there has to have a nice lot with a front yard and a backyard, kind of place that you would raise a family in, and say, no, we're going to make this more like a densely packed urban district that has large apartment complexes with very small apartments densely packed in. And in effect, the federal government takes over the traditional responsibilities of local government, all by threatening to take away that federal grant money.
And of course, as always, they determine what's wrong and what's right just arbitrarily by their own decision. And you have no power to resist. So they could be completely wrong about what your neighborhood and your community is doing, but they'll assess numbers and they will place judgments based on their own grid. I mean, so as you said, they lose local control. You quote Alexis de Tocqueville, which I never heard this part. He talks about the uniqueness of American democracy. Just repeat that phrase, if you would.
Well, that's right, Sandy. Alexis de Tocqueville is one of the great students of American democracy. He came over to the United States in the 1830s from France, and he was truly shocked because in France at that time, and I don't think Europe has changed much since then, unfortunately, but in France in the early 1800s, the central government controlled everything. And local mayors pretty much had to do whatever they were told to do by Paris. And local voters weren't listened to by Paris, and pretty much the center ruled. And Tocqueville came to these small New England towns and saw these little town meetings where the voters were deciding where, say, to build a school and raising the money for taxes and making all these decisions independently. And he was shocked, and he loved it. And he thought, this is exactly what Europe needs. This is what France needs. Americans learn the habits of liberty through their practice of local government. And Europe, he felt, didn't have anything like it. And this is what he believed made America exceptional. In fact, this was really the beginning of the whole idea of American exceptionalism, came from Tocqueville's study. Of course, the Puritans and John Winthrop propagated this idea of America as a city on a hill. But in terms of studying America from the outside and say, hey, there's really something different about it, something special that contrasts tremendously with Europe, it was Tocqueville who discovered this when he discovered America's practice of local government. And the problem with this affirmatively furthering fair housing regulation is that it really completely undercuts the core of what has made America unique for all these years. And as Tocqueville said, it's the school of liberty. It's by going to your local meetings and electing your local officials and arguing these local issues that Americans learn to be free, learn to take the initiative. And at the core level, that's the worst thing about these new regulations that the Obama administration has put out.
All right, so if Ben Carson should make it through confirmation, and I sort of think, if they have to just have 51 votes, I just can't imagine him not making it through. What can he do to stop this particular regulation?
Well, I think ultimately the regulation should just be completely pulled back. But he has a lot of different choices he could make. He could simply keep it, but not enforce it very hard. In other words, he could do very little to remove the money from districts that didn't go along with every jot and tittle of the regulation. He could prevent his. It really takes a lot of intense activity to enforce this on local governments. So Carson could pull it back in many ways. And one irony in all of this is that the Obama administration and liberal supporters of this regulation have taken the approach of not talking about it because they understand very well that the American
Let me interrupt you because we're taking a break here, but I'm going to come back with that thought. This is Dr. Stan Kurtz. We're talking about Dr. Ben Carson perhaps taking over the Housing and Urban Development and what he has to face and how it affects all of us. I'll be right back. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Christmas from American Family Radio and Sandy Rios in the morning. Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
With you, hard to believe it's Christmas. We're talking about all this serious stuff, but time marches on, and some things are eternal and some things are temporal, and certainly we're talking about something, and hopefully this one will be truly temporal. My guest is Dr. Stan Kurtz, and we're talking about Dr. Ben Carson being nominated to be the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And when we last spoke a few minutes ago, Stan was talking about how the Obama administration does not want to talk about their plan to sort of nationalize the choices of who lives where, in what kind of density, what color. They want to control communities everywhere, do away with local zoning rules, and they want to create a very dense population, I guess, for the purpose of being able to control your lives more thoroughly. All of this done through an executive order. And Stan, you said before the break that the Obama administration hasn't talked about this much, and you think there's a reason for it.
Well, that's right, Sandy. And really what has struck me in the last few days is I've never seen so many articles about the affirmatively furthering fair housing regulation. In the past, the reaction of its liberal supporters was to keep quiet about it because they understood very well that if Americans got wind of what this regulation actually did, it would be a political disaster for President Obama and the Democratic Party. But now that Dr. Carson has been nominated, everyone is talking about Dr. Carson's opposition to this regulation, and I find this very interesting. Now, you began our segment with a little news clip there that described this regulation as something that was trying to oppose segregation. That's a great example of how the media does talk about this issue when they talk about it at all. Well, everyone thinks, well, segregation is a bad thing, so what's wrong with opposing segregation? But when people hear the word segregation, what comes to mind is all sorts of rules and regulations that would actually discriminate overtly against people on grounds of race or ethnicity, and that's not what's going on with this regulation at all. This regulation is trying to negate local government. It's trying to tell people where to live. It's actually a thoroughly race-conscious regulation trying to manipulate and control people's free choices. It has nothing to do with fighting discrimination in the traditional sense of opposing segregation. So what I will be interested to see is when Ben Carson goes through his hearings, will the Democrats really hone in on his opposition to this regulation? And if they do, will the Republicans have the good sense to talk about what this regulation was actually trying to accomplish and why Ben Carson was right to oppose it? Because the news stories that go into it say almost nothing about the conservative case against these regulations. They quote one after another the most left-leaning housing advocates, and they never actually explain why conservatives oppose this regulation.
The only person I've heard speak about it, well, it doesn't mean it's the only person that's spoken about it, but it's Senator Lee. He weighed in on this and had a good understanding of it. Do you have any other because you've been writing about this, Stan, and as I said before in the first segment, you probably have more knowledge and have tried to expose this more than anyone that I know. Any other allies on the Hill who have really made themselves expert on this?
Well, Senator Lee is exactly the person who has spoken most about this. Senator Lee's efforts to defund the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Regulation were joined by people like Senator Tom Cotton, Marco Rubio. But whether they have the expertise and the political courage to discuss this, and I say political courage because as soon as you begin discussing the issue, you'll be accused of being a racist, even though I don't think racism has anything to do with opposition to this regulation. But that's why Republicans are quiet about it.
Yeah.
So I think Lee would be a great person to speak. But let's see if Tom Cotton, who clearly has political aspirations for the future, decides to speak up, and Marco Rubio, who I'm sure is young enough to have aspirations as well.
Stan, I'm a little confused about one thing. It is an executive order. We talked about that a few minutes ago. Can Donald Trump simply strike this executive order and kind of unring the bell with that?
He can, I think. I think this is technically a regulation rather than an executive order, but it's really effectively, we're talking about the same thing. This is something that Donald Trump could peel back with the stroke of a pen, as best I understand it. And I think that's what he ought to do. Whether he will do so, I don't know. They may choose to simply enforce the regulation more weakly, but I think it really needs to be completely peeled back. But I just don't know. And again, it's very interesting to see how this will be handled, because the media will try to stop them and will scream bloody murder if they peel it back. And yet, that will force the media to talk about a regulation, which if the American people hear about it, they will say, well, yes, it ought to be struck from the books. So this is really... It's interesting and unprecedented precisely because this doesn't get talked about.
Well, the masters of central planning who have been pushing this and through their president, Barack Obama, also proposed something that I hadn't heard about, that you wrote about a long time ago, and that was called Transit-Oriented Development, TOD, T-O-D, TOD, Transit-Oriented Development. What is that clever scheme that they've been advancing, Stan?
Well, that's right, Sandy. This is yet another aspect of the federal government's attempt to control the way Americans live. Leftist city planners who favor something they call smart growth, I would actually say it's dumb growth or maybe no growth, but the people who favor so-called smart growth believe in this thing called transit-oriented development. What that basically means is packing people like sardines into little apartments that are all built around subway stops and train stations. They want development to be around the nexus of transportation. Why? Well, for one thing, they want people to get out of their cars. These are folks who just don't like suburbia, and they don't like people commuting, partly because they claim that the exhaust fumes from the cars will contribute to global warming. But I think it's more than that. I think it's the dislike of a whole suburban lifestyle. And frankly, I think it's a kind of hostility to the living conditions that make families more comfortable and likely to have children. And some people claim, and I think there's some substance to it, although I've never found the smoking gun proof of it, but some people claim that Democrats would like to move their voters around to different districts maybe change the way the demographics of the country are in such a way as to help the Democrats take back Congress. So there are all sorts of reasons why the supporters of smart growth might favor these policies. But what it comes down to is they really want people out of their cars and living in tightly packed, dense developments near train stations so they can presumably take public transportation to work instead of be free to drive around as they please.
Stan, I remember long before you and I talked about this years ago, I can't remember the origin of this, but the whole notion that, okay, and I may be using the wrong terms, but this is my impression, that the Marxist movement wanted people in city centers and not in rural areas because they're more easily controlled if they live together in urban areas as opposed to suburban or even, you know, rural parts of the country, that there's this overall effort to move people to live more closely so that they can be better controlled. Your thoughts about that? Because I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Well, it's true that even to this day, you see in communist China, and China, despite its sort of experimentation with capitalism, still has a strong communist aspect to it. They do try to move the rural peasants into cities, and the government essentially orders that. It's not unrelated to what's going on here, but it's not exactly the same, because what's happening here is that this transit-oriented development and other kinds of dense development are being encouraged by the federal government, not necessarily only or even primarily in cities, but in suburbs and even in small towns that we might consider to be in semi-rural areas. So, for example, Hillary Clinton lives in Westchester County, as you mentioned earlier in the show. Westchester is a suburb. It's a distant suburb. And yet, under this new regulation, Westchester is being forced to build high-density, low-income housing developments, and there will also be pressure to then maybe build transportation hubs near those. So it's really almost an attempt to urbanize the suburbs and to semi-urbanize rural areas. And again, people have argued that in this case, there's a political motivation behind it, because what we saw in this election is that it's very hard for the Democrats to win congressional districts because all of their voters now are too densely packed into the cities. And what they actually need to do to take over Congress is to spread those voters out to the less densely populated suburban and rural districts. And this regulation, which would effectively create kind of little miniature downtowns in suburbs and in small towns across the country, would be a way of doing that potentially.
You know, you also mentioned that on this Todd, I love these little names, that we're talking about, where they create these dense populations, that it's done in stages, that initially there's plenty of parking, you know, outside these stacked upon stacked small places to live. But the eventual goal is to do away with more and more parking until there is no parking and people are forced to give up their cars. So this is kind of a convergence of lots of great things for the left. It's all the things, I mean, it's what I talked about with, I think, it's the international Marxist movement to move people to urban centers and control them. But it's also the environmentalists who are getting their dream of people giving up their cars. And then it's, doing away with suburbanites and also then, of course, getting more Democratic voters moved around so that they can control more districts. So it's like a win-win-win for them, is it not?
That's right, Sandy. The only fly in the ointment is that the American people, the more they would learn about this, they would absolutely hate and reject it. So that creates the whole problem. And you see, even in that tactic that you so correctly described there, this idea that you build a large, dense apartment building near a train station, and at first you have parking lots around it, nothing seems out of the ordinary, but then you build another apartment building on that parking lot, and pretty soon you've got an area filled with apartment buildings but no parking lots, leaving people with no choice but to abandon their cars and to take the subway or whatever the public transit is there, the train of some sort. And so you see that this is sort of a stealthy tactic. You do it slowly because you know that if you publicize what your intention is, the people will reject it. And I think the American people, frankly, have begun to catch on. They may not know every little jot and tittle about the affirmatively furthering fair housing regulation, but they're beginning to understand that Washington has a lot of manipulative and quiet plans for them that they essentially don't like, and they have effectively risen up and rejected all that.
Well, it's amazing. And all of this, I have to say, we're almost out of time here, Sam, but there's actually been, I don't think, too much discussion on the nomination of Dr. Ben Carson, and maybe this is the reason they really don't know what to say. They just can't find the words because, as you said, Republicans don't want to be accused of being racist, which is a totally unjust and unfounded accusation on this issue. And the Democrats are up to no good, and they don't want to talk about it. So this will be a fascinating confirmation process, probably more fascinating than we had anticipated. Stan Kurtz, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I do appreciate so much your time and your expertise and your honesty and integrity. Thank you so much, Stan.
And thanks for having me, Sandy.
Okay, my pleasure. All right. Well, Sandy Rios, once again, with more information. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you later. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.